Michael Macquarie est professeur de sociologie à la London School of Economics. Il a co-dirigé deux volumes, Remaking Urban Citizenship, Organizations, Institutions and the Right to the City, ainsi qu'un autre volume, Democratizing Inequalities, The Promise and Pitfalls of the New Public Participation. Il travaille actuellement sur un ouvrage intitulé The Community Builders, qui présente ses recherches sur la trajectoire des organisations locales dans la gouvernance urbaine sur les 40 dernières années. Sa communication s'intitule La question raciale et les technologies participatives dans la ville néolibérale.
So, the name of this talk on the program is a placeholder, which has been revised. So, the talk is better described by Black politics to colorblind consensus, race and participation in the neoliberal city. In my view, the neoliberal era has not been kind to African Americans. This is not news. It's often commented upon. Nonetheless, I think much of the discussion about neoliberalism and African Americans in particular misses the mark, especially to the degree it is overly concerned with criminalization. I think that I say overly concerned with criminalization, not because I think criminalization is at issue. It's not. We have contemporary movement mobilizations all over the United States right now that are specifically concerned with criminalization. That's probably for a reason. But it's because the criminalization, the emphasis on criminalization misses another important side of the institutional coin in the neoliberal era. Neoliberal political projects, in my view, are not well served by the simple criminalization of minorities. In fact, institutionalizing a new Jim Crow, as some people, some legal scholars in particular, have hypothesized has happened in the United States, would fly directly in the face of the main ideological imperative of neoliberalism, in my view, which is to extend market conceptions of value to non-market institutional settings where normative values had prevailed. This is a definition that is discussed at greater length by my former colleague Stephanie Mudge in her article, What is Neoliberalism? In order to sustain the illusion and the authority of neoliberal discourse, neoliberal institutional rollout, rollout being the second phase of neoliberal institutional transformation, in Neil Brenner's words, there's a rollback phase, which rolls back collective institutions, social welfare institutions, the New Deal, and rollout, which rolls out market-based, individualized institutions, right? Neoliberal institutional rollout makes room for African Americans who successfully conform to the value-producing demands of neoliberal ideology. This can take many possible forms and can be reflected in a variety of different markets. Labor markets, certainly, but economic value can also be created through entrepreneurial activity, starting businesses, or through the realization of paper value, for example, by doing things like taking out loans on a house. Indeed, this last is central to the story in Cleveland, the city I'm going to focus on. So denied access for decades, African Americans suddenly won access to credit markets in the late 1970s on the back of a wave of neighborhood mobilizations that resulted in the passage of the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and the Community Reinvestment Act. By 1990, black neighborhoods were being greenlined, the opposite of redlining. That is, they were having dubious loans thrust upon them. It's not that they were being denied access to credit anymore. They were getting too much credit. Of course, the paper wealth generated by this activity did not end up accruing to borrowers. We know that now. The foreclosure crisis took care of that quite decisively, but to loan securitizers and the people who traded in these securities. So in political terms, what I want to argue is that the flip side of criminalization is not Jim Crow-style exclusion. It is access. African Americans decisively won political access in Cleveland in the 1960s, and there's no sign that they're about to lose it anytime soon, even if the relevance of that victory has been significantly diminished, which it has. The trick from the perspective of elites is to prevent access and participation from resulting in the creation of an African-American collective political subject, and this paper is concerned primarily with that trick. Okay. So the question I ask is simple. How have access and participation been bent to the purpose of sustaining African-American socioeconomic marginalization? My research prompts me to approach this question, my research on a number of topics, prompts me to approach this question through mostly an institutional and an organizational lens that is primarily concerned with three questions. What is the realm of political possibility attached to the configuration of institutions and organizations in a given city, in this case Cleveland? how do these intersect with the particular constraints and dilemmas that attach to being African-American, and how has neoliberalism altered these arrangements? I approach these questions from the perspective of particular, what I call technologies of political participation. I developed this idea more in an article in Public Culture called No Contest, and in the volume that I co-edited with Caroline Lee and Edward Walker on democratizing inequalities. So technologies of participation, by which I mean configurations or mangles of rules, institutions, laws, norms, organizations, and practices that have discrete effects on both the people who utilize them and on their organizational context. Based on this, I want to generally describe the construction of a politics of colorblind consensus, colorblind in quotes, in Cleveland and the effects the associated set of political practices have had on the possibilities of black politics. Okay, so two things that I want to know before I get completely rolling here. This would just be a basic visualization of what I want to describe, okay? 1982 in Cleveland. Cleveland was the epicenter of a nationwide neighborhood mobilization against the concentration of investment in urban downtowns. It was cross-race. It was cross-class. This followed significant civil rights mobilizing and other types of mostly African-American mobilizing in Cleveland that had resulted in the election of the first African-American mayor of a large American city. Carl Stokes was elected in 1967. Black access was institutionalized very early on the back of contentious politics. But by 2002, most of that had disappeared. And the basic scene in civil society was more like this. This is an awards dinner. What's being given out is the Lewis Stokes Community Visionary Award. Lewis Stokes was the brother of Carl Stokes. He was a longtime congressman from Northeast Ohio. This is sort of what these organizations do now. They give each other awards and they build houses. So how did this happen? All right. I'm not going to get too much into this, but I want to show this off for two reasons. One, I'm in France, and I'm hoping French sociologists will go, oh, an American understands French sociology. What this is a multiple correspondence analysis of civil society organizations in Cleveland, Ohio, organized at the community scale that claim to represent a community. The thing that I want to point out here is that this really created the puzzle for the paper. What this is a map of is similarities and differences in all of these civil society organizations. And so what we're doing is interpreting the main axes of differentiation in the space. Which, writ large, it tells you more or less what's possible in Cleveland civil society. The interesting thing is that the main axis, which opposes professionalization and economic resources on the right to non-professionalization and few economic resources on the left, does not map onto race. In other words, it makes no difference in those terms whether or not the organization is in a black neighborhood or a white neighborhood. More importantly, it does map a little bit onto the second axis, which mostly distinguishes types of social capital, with public and political being top, civic, private on the bottom. That does map onto race. However, interestingly, the opposition is not black versus white. It's relatively diverse versus polarized neighborhoods, with the polarized ones on the top most closely affiliated with political and bureaucratic. The reason that I say this is because when I wrote No Contest, I had a reviewer who reasonably complained that I was not addressing race in this field. And the reason that I wasn't addressing race in this field was because race wasn't mapping onto my data. That reviewer was named Mary Patillo. And since that time, I have been thinking about how can we talk about race here when it's not mapping onto this data, right? So thank you, Mary. She did not know that this was coming, but.
I did know I was the reviewer of the paper.
Yes, right. Okay. How to think about this. Just in terms of trying to organize my understanding of the transformation that has occurred in the transition to neoliberal institutional transformation, I'm mostly looking at, I'm thinking about the different ways that it is possible in Cleveland to mobilize in African-American neighborhoods to secure resources that can be distributed to African-Americans, very basic concern, right? And sort of how they have changed over time. And so I mapped the five most important ones that you sort of see that are evident in community-based organizations, that are evident in social movement mobilizations. And these are sorts of the five you come up with. Clientelist, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Reformist, which I'll talk about in a minute. Contentious, which are movement mobilizations and which are dead by 1982. Specifically, local philanthropies cut off all funding for any sort of contentious community mobilization. That killed off the last vestiges of the movement in Cleveland. Technocratic, which I'll talk about in a minute, and consensus, which I'm actually not going to get to, but it's an important part of this. The technocratic mode was so clearly not incorporating or energizing or mobilizing neighborhood residents that they actually had to figure out sort of new ways of doing this that wouldn't be threatening. And that technology is called consensus organizing, which is organizing people to not have arguments. I mean, it's like a thing. It's supported by the Ford Foundation. It's disseminated all across the country. It's kind of a big deal. But that sort of reemerges in Cleveland in 2002 in particular. Philanthropy starts doing this. All right. So the other thing that I want to note about this is that if we think about neoliberal institutional rollout, that really gets going in 1986. Two things mark that in 1986. The first is that growth-oriented elites in Cleveland are struggling to deal with rapid decline, and they form an organization called Cleveland Tomorrow, which is the first organization that is meant to strategically reorganize the policy paradigms that are operating in Cleveland and using private money to do so. It's an organization of CEOs only. They pay dues, they use the dues to fund organizations which create and implement these new policies. The second is the passage of the low-income housing tax credit, which is a model of doing housing provision which is dependent upon being able to market projects to institutional investors. In other words, they have to deliver a yield. Okay. All right. Whoops, I went backwards. That's the wrong way. Can I go forwards? There we go. All right, so reformist politics. I want to be relatively brief with this, but I do want to flag a couple of important things here. The most basic thing is that between 1945 and 1980, a number of African-American reformers who were associated with civil rights were elected to office in Cleveland. The most important of these was, of course, Carl Stokes. You know, it's not that uncommon to find in sort of northeastern and midwestern cities African-American politicians being elected by their wards because there's residential concentration. I mean, African-Americans are residentially concentrated, so if you have a ward-based legislative system, you're always going to end up with African-American politicians, but they're always going to be councilors. They're not going to be mayors. Carl Stokes is elected mayor, and so he sort of was the first one to kind of pull off this trick in a city where African-Americans were still not a majority. Stokes was elected based on the combined power of African-American neighborhood mobilizations that were originally about school funding but became to be generally about equity and the distribution of governmental resources. So white councilors would collude to ensure that all the resources got funneled into white neighborhoods. They were trying to stop that. So this is significant mobilization. The second part, though, is that actually he was supported by the city's growth-oriented elites. And this is a very interesting moment. Carl Stokes didn't just represent reform in terms of racial politics. He represented reform in terms of civic politics. He was understood to be somebody who would look out for the best interests of the city as a whole, who would be interested in things like public disclosures of where funding goes. He would be interested in things like the reasonable debate of good policy, and so on like this. And what it reflects is two things. One is that unlike today, an African-American politician can stand for the civic in 1967. Today they can't, or they have tremendous difficulty doing so. The second is the hatred that both growth-oriented elites and African-American civil rights activists had towards ward-based, clientelistic, white ethnic politicians. That mutual enmity organized this collaboration. White councilors prevented Stokes from pursuing his agenda. Local growth-oriented elites said, that's fine, we'll fund your agenda anyway, and raised $177 million in private money for Stokes to distribute through new community development corporations in African-American neighborhoods on the east side of Cleveland. That's big money, $177 million in 1967, that's big money. And that's real support, right? Okay. The problem is that the support of white elites didn't last. Part of the deal was that Stokes would be able to keep a lid on riots. There'd been a riot in the Huff neighborhood in 1965. The idea was that we can, if we support an African-American politician for mayor, we'll be able to sort of get a handle on rioting and African-American discontent. Unfortunately, that didn't work. In 1968, the Glenville riot broke out, and it was sparked by a black nationalist who, it turns out, had armed himself using Cleveland Now money, which was not good. He shot a cop. And this was one of the first things that prompted business elites to start backing off. The second was that Stokes was smart. He understood that he could not perpetually rely upon the support of white business elites, and he tried to institutionalize the terms that would allow for the reproduction of black reformist politics. So what did he do? He tried to create an all-black party organization because the white-dominated county party organization would never give any money to African-American politicians. He tried to reorganize the COG, Committee on Government, which is a very opaque aspect of American government, but which distributes all federal money. He tried to reorganize the representation of that to better represent African-Americans. And he opened up government to, he opened up the civil service, municipal bureaucracy to African-Americans, right, in jobs other than sanitation. It's a ridiculous fact of American municipal government that African-Americans had always had access to civil service, but it was always picking up garbage. He opened up the municipal bureaucracy to African-Americans generally. And given that this is still a moment when lots of federal funds are flowing into the city, this helps facilitate the creation of new municipal unions that are often majority black, which also serves to create a voter base which is very tightly connected to black reformist politicians. Right? Okay. He's unsuccessful in reorganizing the party apparatus. The Glenville riots undermine the support of local growth-oriented elites. But the most important thing, of course, is that civil rights movement mobilizations declined. Okay. It picked up a little bit in the mobilization with the mobilizations of neighborhoods in the 1970s, but the relevant fact here is that the mobilizations in the 1970s were undertaken in the name of community, a raceless community. And as a result, the idea of African-American particularity was being subsumed even in the movement mobilizations that succeeded civil rights. Okay? Right. All right. Clientelist politics, which on that that table of the participatory palette in Cleveland is the most robust. It lasts the longest in Cleveland, and it sort of is able to sustain itself most effectively for the longest, is a element of municipal politics which is not usually dealt with very well. People tend to overlook it. Nicole Marwell is somebody who actually does try and grapple with this quite straightforwardly. The pictures here, these people are going to be talking about in a second. I don't know if anybody recognizes Dennis Kucinich. He ran for mayor, ran for president as recently as 2004 on a peace platform. He's an acknowledged UFO sighter. This is his first elected position, second elected position. He was elected mayor of Cleveland in 1977. Not surprisingly, he was known as the boy mayor. The person next to him is George Forbes, who is a clientelist black politician who was president of council for about 15 years. Basically ran the city. And I'm guessing nobody ever called him the boy counselor, based on that picture. But Forbes became a power broker in Cleveland. The person on the bottom is a woman named Fannie Lewis, who started out as a reformist politician, but eventually became the apotheosis of the clientelist politician as far as her enemies were concerned. Where she's sitting in this picture is relevant because that is a place called Lexington Village, which was a very large housing redevelopment project in Huff, undertaken when there are very few tools to do so, and undertaken with that specific community's idea of what their community should look like. It wasn't being told to them how to do it. It wasn't public housing. It wasn't simply new ranch-style houses, anything like that. I spent several weeks sort of following her around, mostly to understand clientelism. It's probably the thing that she is most proud of. It's something like 600 units. It's a very big development. But okay, all right. So clientelism, most simply, is the exchange of goods and services for political support. It is an extremely common type of exchange in American politics, but one that is varyingly common in cities because of the viability of the practice, because the viability of the practice is heavily dependent on the organization of representation. cities that were incorporated after the progressive movement generally don't have ward-based council systems. So cities west of the Mississippi, not that many of them are organized in a way that would sustain clientelism. Cleveland is a hothouse environment for clientelism. Most importantly, the city has a powerful ward-based city council. Due to political deals negotiated between mayors like Kucinich, but more importantly, Kucinich's successor, and power brokers like George Forbes, Cleveland's ward-based council is even able to tap into federal transfers like public housing funds and community development block grants. That means that you don't have sort of a professionalized municipal bureaucracy distributing a lot of federal money. You have clientelist politicians distributing a lot of it on the basis of equity across wards, and maybe not necessarily doing so in the most sort of what we would recognize as technocratic or professionalized way possible. This provides a lot of fuel for clientelist politics in Cleveland. Today, the exchange of access and services for votes usually isn't direct. The main thing that Marwell points out is that usually it's mediated by nonprofit organizations, most importantly, community development corporations. The combination of residential concentration and minority status of African Americans in American cities means that they are positioned especially well to take advantage of clientelist exchange. This was not true until you started getting new community and urban policies that were specifically targeted at poor communities. And that happened beginning with the War on Poverty, the Community Action Program, and so on. Community Development Block Grant is simply another step in that development. Low-income housing tax credits would be another example of that. Okay. The priority of politicians in clientelist exchange is usually to use it to ensure election victories. And indeed, many of the longest-tenured politicians in Cleveland's recent history engage regularly in clientelist practices and were frequently accused and sometimes successfully prosecuted, George Forbes, for corruption. Okay. So dealing with Lewis, we have somebody who began as a reformer, does things like captures resources to distribute in an African-American community in a way that is not being defined by white elites, whether they be government bureaucrats, philanthropists, or anything else. She's now passed, but in 2004, she passed a law called the Fannie Lewis Law, which is an example of it's a rare example of a piece of legislation that gets passed which flies directly in the face of the universalizing and marketizing logic of neoliberalism. So the point of the Fannie Lewis Law is that whenever a physical redevelopment project takes place, whenever you're hiring people, 40% of your hires have to come from the neighborhood in which the project is taking place. That is a huge number. Now, this is catnip for clientelists, this kind of law, right? Because it enables you to claim that you're standing up for your constituents against the neoliberalizing, marketizing logic of all the nasty philanthropists, which she does regularly. But at the same time, it also provides you with all kinds of fuel for clientelist exchange. So your average big contractor, Forest City, is a national contractor that's based in Cleveland. They want to do a stadium redevelopment project. They have no way of figuring out how to get 40% of their workforce from Huff, where Fannie Lewis is the counselor. They engage with her to scare up all of these people, and that's all jobs, which get translated into votes and so on like that. It's perfect. This kills two birds with one stone. It's the ideal piece of legislation. Her trajectory, though, also does reveal how precarious clientelism was becoming, even despite the Fannie Lewis Law. Declining federal transfers, federal retrenchment, the city's ongoing fiscal crisis meant that there was the flow of money that she could tap into, which has been shrinking, and that all clientelist politicians could tap into, have been shrinking over the last 30 years, making this position less and less viable. By the time I was interviewing her, I started realizing that a lot of people that were showing around the neighborhood were ex-cons. And what she was doing was she was using halfway houses as a way of sustaining clientelist exchange. So ex-cons became people that she could sort of boss around, and she could use them to do things like work on other people's jobs, fix up their houses, things like that, and use that as a way of exchanging for votes, right? But that is a very problematic way of approaching this because, of course, she, like many leaders in black communities, are really against the idea of putting socially problematic organizations and institutions, concentrating them in poor black neighborhoods. She thinks that that's wrong. So it's sort of her caving into imperatives that arise from the declining flow of funds. Okay. So the clientele's position is fiscally vulnerable. It's also vulnerable to calls for greater transparency, more efficient reporting, demands for the more efficient use of available resources. Many people think this is a good thing. People want resources to be used more efficiently. Reformers, journalists, community activists, technocrats, and so on regularly criticize clientelist politicians. A journalist in Cleveland once described Fannie Lewis as a Maoist to me, which I thought was hilarious for any number of reasons, but most importantly being Americans don't usually use the term Maoist as a way of insulting somebody. It's just kind of rare. but so she's a Maoist, unclear why. The style of authority of clientelist politicians seems manipulative and undemocratic. It often rests on personal relationships rather than the pursuit of the public good. Between 2000 and 2010, the battle against clientelism was stepped up considerably in Cleveland. Local philanthropies in particular targeted these politicians directly by training and supporting a bench of challengers. You train a bunch of African-American politicians from these neighborhoods, how to run election campaigns, so on like that, but also promise them access to resources if they get elected, right? So you're creating a bench of challengers. They tie funding to governance reforms, particularly in the way boards are organized, and they tie funding to fiscal controls. The effort, though, is probably unnecessary. Clientelist practices are difficult enough to reproduce in politics because the knowledge on which they rest can never be formalized. More importantly, by 2010, the fiscal and policy conditions that had underpinned clientelism were largely gone. But I want to emphasize that what went with it was the only mode of politics left in Cleveland at that time, which was premised upon African-American access to and use of resources to address the specific problems of African-American neighborhoods, not problems that happened to be common to African-American neighborhoods and white neighborhoods, right? That ended basically with clientelism. By the way, in the MCA map, you can see this immediately. By 2010, there's a clientelist quadrant, and all those organizations are dead. They die between 2004 and 2010. They're gone, which is rare. Organizations don't die very much. They should die more than they do, but they don't die very much. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about is technocratic politics. The two gentlemen in the pictures, the one on the top is Frank Jackson. He's the current mayor of Cleveland. He recently got elected to his third term. He considers himself to be a disciple of Lonnie Burton, who is an important reformist politician. But Jackson illustrates all of the kinds of dilemmas of trying to be a reformist politician today. Most importantly, you can see this whenever he gives a State of the City speech, because he always opens with a discussion of the budget situation. Right? There's no sort of like policy initiative or like vision for the city. What he's doing is he's performing the idea that I can stand for the civic. Even though I am not white, I can be civic. And he is very careful about doing anything that doesn't sort of look like it's in the interest of the city as a whole. And this flies in the face of his personal disposition. He's a guy who really cares a lot about poverty. He grew up in poverty. He still lives in Central, which is a poor neighborhood on Cleveland's east side. The guy below him is a guy who had been the director of his community development corporation when Jackson was still on council. His name is Timothy Tramble. And his CDC was, in my analysis, was distinctive because he managed to deliver more fiscal reinvestment per dollar than any other community development corporation in the city. He was resolutely focused on numbers. How many houses can I churn out this year? And he did not care about anything else. And he rebuilt huge chunks of the central neighborhood. But as far as he was concerned, the only thing that mattered was the number of houses, because it was the number of houses that was most closely tied to real estate value increase. And real estate values were, in the minds of Cleveland technocratic politicians, civil society, philanthropists, so on like that, real estate values were the best indicator of neighborhood well-being. So if you want neighborhoods to improve, raise real estate values. It's basically the logic. He epitomized this, Timothy Tramble. Okay. So in the 1960s and 1970s, African Americans win access and resources, but it's a hollow victory because economic crisis, restructuring, federal retrenchment drastically shrink the resources available to the municipalities, especially shrinks the resources that are available to the main institutional setting in which African Americans have won access, politics, right? municipal politicians don't have any money anymore. They can't do anything anymore. I used to joke in Cleveland that Frank Jackson basically is a guy who exists to go to police funerals because he can't do anything else. He gives a State of the City speech where he reports on the budget. But, like, that's it. That's all he can do. It's not a great victory anymore to be able to be mayor of a large American city. In the 1980s, we get shifts in policy paradigms from demand-side interventions to supply-side interventions, expanding homeownership, job training, and so on. Shifts go to privileging market mechanisms and social policy, exemplified by the low-income housing tax credit. In the context of Cleveland, this is very bad, and the main reason is that Cleveland is slammed by the economic crisis of the 1970s. The city goes bankrupt in 1979 after a very, very ugly fight between local bankers and Dennis Kucinich, the mayor. The city experiences very rapid decline in both population and economic investment, so it goes from a city that has 31 Fortune 500 companies in 1975 to a city that has 6 today. It had a population of over a million in the 1960s, and now it's a population of 380,000. Things are so bad. By the way, federal funding, a lot of types of federal funding in the U.S. To municipalities are tied to population. Going under 500,000 is a big deal for municipal budgets. Cleveland was so, the politicians in Cleveland were so upset about this, they actually proposed merging with East Cleveland. East Cleveland is a city that makes Cleveland look like, London, okay? Like wealthy, filled with oil oligarchs or something. East Cleveland is desperately poor. The fact that they want to merge with East Cleveland is a sign of desperation. Nobody wants to merge with East Cleveland. The response of the city's growth-oriented elites is to get more strategic. They secure authority for this agenda of physical redevelopment and the revalorization of local real estate, mostly by working through local community-based organizations. They don't work through large centralized development organizations like they had in the 1960s and 70s. The crisis was bad enough that a general consensus emerged in the city for the strategic pursuit of growth by making the city more competitive for mobile capital and mobile people. This project enrolled everybody, business leaders, politicians, civil servants, unions, community activists. In policy terms, this meant concentrating all available resources in the competitive territories of the city and on competitive populations in order to maximize their attractiveness. This meant downtown. It meant University Circle, which is a med-ed complex. It means white neighborhoods. And even in neighborhoods that are not white, black neighborhoods, they are encouraged to pursue competitiveness through a program of nonprofit-led physical redevelopment in which the housing produced is designed to lure in suburban white professionals or affluent African Americans. It is not targeted at the existing population at all. Right? Professionals, the creative class, business owners, these are all desirable populations. In this context, real estate values were institutionalized in municipal government, philanthropies, and CBOs as the main metric. We can see this in the production of lots of maps that look like this. Municipal government in Cleveland discovers GIS, and they say, hi, that's a great way of like measuring real estate values. And basically what this means to a Cleveland, you know, nonprofit manager, municipal bureaucrat, politician is, this tells me where we should funnel all of our resources. And we funnel them in the blue areas, and we don't put any of them in the red areas, because that would be crazy. Why would you ever do that? The red areas happen to be where African Americans live, and the white areas happen to be where white people live. This also effectively, of course, concentrates resources in with the people who least need it. Okay, the blue neighborhoods are not, they're not great. It's Cleveland, but they're not that bad. So new housing gets produced, new commercial spaces get produced, new regionally competitive amenities get produced. I interviewed a community development corporation leader who was dealing with the fact that he had been mandated by city government in exchange for CDBG funding to deal with poverty in the next 3 years. He's like, I'm not so sure I can do that. That seems like an unreasonable request for a $70,000 grant. Right? Like, and his other funder says, we want you to build an amusement park, a regionally competitive amenity. And he's like, okay, right, so I'm going to solve poverty and build an amusement park in the next 3 years. Off I go. And sort of ask him, you know, like, how do you do that? He's like, I don't know, you muddle through. You know, like, I mean, he really had no answer, but that was sort of the dilemmas that a lot of these people get stuck with. The policy paradigm, of course, treats all people as if they are the same. That is, whether or not they can deliver return on investment in terms of real estate values, whether they can productively contribute to the valorization of real estate. The problem, of course, is something that I'm guessing everybody in this room knows, which is that real estate values are not universal. They are not transparent reflections of value. They are highly, highly racialized, right? Good real estate values get appended to white neighborhoods, both through the things you were talking about earlier, but also through the continued reproduction of ideas of what good and bad neighborhoods look like. Right. So what this ends up being is a tool that effectively justifies not putting resources into poor and especially black communities. So the assumption of the policy paradigm justifies this concentration of investment. Some African Americans, of course, benefit. African Americans that can contribute to the valorization of real estate. Affluent people, professionals. In terms of participation, this apparatus is the most disconnected sort of arrangement in Cleveland civil society since the 1950s. Participation is usually limited to experts or selective moments when it's necessary to draw on the local knowledge of residents in community forums. However, unlike bureaucratic technocracies, neoliberal technocracy does not rest on centralized authority. It rests on trans-sectoral public-private partnerships in order to be successful. This has a few implications. If policy success depends upon mobilizing many different actors with many different interests, there's no authoritative arbiter. This requires intermediation, it requires brokering. Ed Mary talks about this a lot at the community level. It requires participation, and the participation and collaboration is inter-organizational. This organizational structure privileges the role of ostensibly abstract and universal metrics like real estate values. It also facilitates a consensus politics. In order to build a house, if it requires that you get six organizations to agree on whether or not to borrow a house, you're going to go to the lowest common denominator of what everybody can agree on. That's what you have to do. So it facilitates, almost obligates anybody who wants to act in Cleveland to participate in the politics of consensus, which, of course, has the corollary of obliterating any appreciation of particularity, the particular needs of some communities, the particular situation of some communities. So, all right. So given the meso-level vantage point I've talked about here, what can we learn? Urban neoliberalism rests on a sophisticated cultural and political configuration which rolls back many of the gains that African Americans made in the 1960s and 1970s while maintaining African American access and participation. As is often the case in urban politics today, the issue is rarely about whether or not there is participation and inclusion. It is about how participation and inclusion are utilized by different actors in the polity. In terms of specifics, the story is ironic. As in Vacance and Wilson's socioeconomic account, I want to emphasize that African Americans decisively want access to institutional arenas, municipal government and electoral politics, which have been declining in significance since that victory. Government resources and governmental authority don't matter much when governments have few resources for discretionary spending and action requires collaboration between multiple organizations. Of course, politicians and municipal officials still have considerable say over what happens in the city, but there is very little scope for autonomous governmental action on behalf of constituents, the creation of which means that having Frank Jackson as your mayor isn't really all that helpful. The creation of a partnership city, as Cleveland has been called, in governance is not necessarily problematic for African Americans. The issue of inter-organizational collaboration is always about creating the conditions and terms that enable mutual recognition of value. However, in a context of alarming urban decline and a federal policy consensus around the use of private and market action to address social needs, a local consensus hardened around the need to improve competitiveness. People and policies were increasingly being scrutinized for their potential to yield returns on investment. Market conceptions of value quickly spilled into non-market arenas, most evident in the institutionalization of real estate values as the most important metric of neighborhood well-being. Of course, the power of such ideas is that they are depoliticized, objective measurements which are not dependent on context. They are universal. As such, they are easy to grasp and use. But of course, we know they aren't really universal. The effect of using a racialized metric that is understood as a universal reflection of objective value is that most, but most importantly not all, African Americans come to be understood as poor investments. To the extent blacks demand resource allocations, they are inefficient burdens on the city's competitiveness. When competitiveness is the most important characteristic of civicness, African Americans are situated increasingly, and unlike in the 1960s, as anti-civic burdens on the polity. The result is another layer of stigmatization and marginalization. In this context, the logic of action for African-American leaders and politicians shifts from one in which the goal is to secure resources for constituents to one which is about the performance of civicness. This is accomplished through acceptance and propagation of the technocratic consensus, evident not just in the public actions of Frank Jackson and Tim Tramble, but politicians, philanthropists, community activists, and nonprofit managers generally. What is subsumed is not African-American participation, but black politics, by which I mean the politics that attach to the ontology of a frequently marginalized minority. African-Americans who are investable participate and occupy leadership positions in the city, but they do not have the cultural or institutional space to address the dilemmas and harm associated with that ontology. Black particularity has been excised from urban politics in the neoliberal era. Thanks.